This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The Democratic Party, it's got to be said, is at its lowest point in generations, on the state level, the national level, in Congress, and it's all divided up into factions with different points of view on how to rebuild. Certainly one of the strongest figures to emerge in recent years, someone admired throughout most of the party, is Elizabeth Warren. As the senior senator from Massachusetts, holding Ted Kennedy's old seat, she's been pushing a progressive economic agenda for the future. And she seemed to relish getting into it with Donald Trump on Twitter, first when he was a candidate, and now that he's president. Warren has written a book called This Fight is Our Fight, The Battle to Save America's Middle Class, and I sat down with her earlier this week. Senator Warren, it's not quite 100 days.
Not quite.
Not quite, but we'll get there very, very soon. And I want to begin, of all things, with a statistic. Every one of the 493 wealthiest counties, mainly urban, voted for Hillary Clinton. The remaining 2,623 counties, largely small towns, suburbs, rural areas, voted for Donald Trump. Which tells us what?
I think it tells us there's a lot of trouble out there in America, and that America is dividing again along economic lines. But I'm going to make a pitch here that that's not the most crucial number to look at. It's not the question about who can pick up 52% of the vote or 54% of the vote. For me, what this is really about is how we have this whole set of economic statistics that tell us the world is doing great. Rising GDP, the stock market is breaking one record after another, unemployment is down. But in fact, those statistics have giant blind spots in them. There was a time when they didn't, when rising GDP meant everybody was getting richer, when we had an America where, you know, if those at the top were getting richer, so were those in the middle and so were those at the bottom. In fact, can I do a statistic on that one? Let me
Please.
Pull off to that. 90% of all people in America get about 70% of all the income growth from 1935 to 1980. In other words, pie's getting bigger and we're all getting more to eat, right? Then, 1980 to 2016, time period two, what changes? Ronald Reagan trickled down economics, cut taxes for those at the top. That leaves less money for investment in education, in infrastructure, in basic research. Deregulate the banks, let them run wild. And what happens? 1980 to 2016, GDP keeps going up. In other words, our country continues to get richer. But the 90%, how much did they get of the new income growth then? And the answer, nothing.
Now, what you're saying was certainly part of the vocabulary of Bernie Sanders and to some extent the vocabulary eventually, at mm-hmm. least, if not often enough, of Hillary Clinton. And yet the other guy won. The other guy won, at least in the Electoral College where it counts. And what bewitches liberals all the time, myself included, very often, is this notion that somehow that people are not necessarily voting their interests. What was Donald Trump's appeal in the election, as you look back at it, and it took you by surprise as much as it took anybody by surprise. Why did he win? How did he form a populism that appealed to exactly the people that you're talking about in large part? And he outdistanced the Democrats.
So the first thing that Donald Trump started with was an acknowledgement that this economy is not working for a lot of people. He didn't happy face the numbers. He didn't say 8 more years of what you've had. He said, this economy is not working for you, and I get that. And then he made a very solemn promise. I will make this economy work for you. I know how to do that. I understand about a rigged game because I've been on the other end of it. That was Donald Trump's promise.
In fact, you almost titled one of your books, The System is Rigged, which became a phrase of his.
Yeah. No. And I used
kindred,
it.
Kindred spirits.
Well, except we divide rather sharply in two places. The first is that Donald Trump told a story about what went wrong. And his story is blame it on everybody else.
The other.
Blame the other. On immigrants. Blame it on African Americans. Blame it on Latinos. Blame it on people who don't look like you. Blame it on people who don't worship like you. That was the core of Donald Trump's message. But the second part is
Were you surprised that it took hold the way it did?
You know, look, you probably need a pundit for that sort of thing. But the truth is for somebody to get up and say, yeah, I get it. This economy is not working. That part didn't surprise me at all. One of the things I try to talk about a lot in this book is the lived experience of America, what it's like when you work hard, you play by the rules, and just always keep slipping behind. The thing now for Donald Trump, and I think this is going to be I think this is a transition moment, is that it's not just what Donald Trump says. It's what Donald Trump does that's going to matter.
Senator Warren, at some point, politically, Donald Trump is going to have to make good on some of these promises, not to bankers, but rather to the middle class or the working poor, and can't just do it on anecdote, can't just say, here are 300 jobs at Carrier Air Conditioning, or coal mines are not coming back. In the sense that he means it. A great deal of the old manufacturing base is not coming back. In what way do you think he plans to deliver, and can he deliver in his policy terms?
I'll give him a way he can deliver right now. He can deliver. He said all during the campaign that he was in favor of breaking up the big banks, that he was in favor of Glass-Steagall. Shoot, I've got my Glass-Steagall bill. I've been working on this for a long time. And I've got my co-sponsors. I got John McCain as my co-sponsor, and Maria Cantwell and Angus King. We've got people who will do this. Donald, come on. I'll bring the Democrats. You bring some Republicans. Let's make this happen. There are things that he could do if he's willing to get out there and make it happen. Shoot, he could do it on tax reform. On tax reform, you could actually stitch up the loopholes and use that money right here for our kids. I'll give you one example on that. I graduated from a commuter college that cost $50 a semester. I graduated in an America where student loans were subsidized. That is, kids were paying less than banks were paying in order to get money to go to school. Why? Because America believed that if you were willing to work hard and you were willing to come through that door, by golly, you ought to have a chance to get an education. Today, the federal government is making billions of dollars in profits off the backs of our kids. I proposed a bill that said, let's cut the interest rate on student loans. And the way we'll pay for it is let's stitch up one of the tax loopholes for billionaires. That's just a straight, where do you want to spend your money? Do you want to spend it on tax loopholes for billionaires, or do you want to spend it on young people who are trying to get an education? Donald Trump could jump on that. Come on.
How do you negotiate with President Trump without getting rolled, without having the Romney effect?
The answer is, he wants an audience, give him an audience. Whenever you're negotiating with Donald Trump, if we got a lot of America already on our side, I think that's how you get his attention and get to a good result.
What's the experience being in a room with him and talking with him? Are you talking to a responsive being?
I've never been over there.
You expect to get an invitation?
Not soon.
Not soon.
God.
Senator, taxes have become the next big fight, or mm-hmm. one of the next big fights. And I want to ask you, as someone who has a profound academic background in economics, if you had Donald Trump's taxes, what would you be looking for?
Oh.
How would you analyze them? What would you zero in on?
So I want to know what he's hiding. Think about it this way. He has been willing to take what a lot of people would think are a whole lot of punches over his taxes. But the fact that he won't reveal them, and he quite openly said, oh, yeah, I don't pay any taxes or haven't paid any taxes at points in the past. That means I'm just smart. Okay. So both of those, that means that's not what he's hiding. He's not hiding that. What is he hiding? Is he hiding his business ties? We know from little bits and pieces of outside sources that he has ties to some pretty shady folks around the world. Is that what he's hiding? What is it that would be revealed? Who has he borrowed money from? Who does he still owe money to? Because there are a lot of people, I think, in this country who would say, wow, if he owes money to Russian oligarchs, it makes me really uneasy when he's making decisions about the future of our country.
Senator, I wonder if you think that there is adequate evidence yet accumulated to be suspicious that in any way the Trump circle or Trump himself had colluded with Russia in a way that should cause great alarm.
Oh, okay. So let's be clear about what we know for sure. Our intelligence community has concluded that Russia hacked into American systems in order to influence the outcome of the 2016
Now, have you seen
election.
Evidence of that I have not?
Yes.
You have. And it's convincing to you?
Yes. The second thing is that we know that there is an active and ongoing investigation by the FBI of the relationship between Trump, the Trump campaign, and Russia. And third, we know that Flynn, a high-level Trump advisor, had to resign because of his close ties and connections and what he'd said with Russia. Now, to me, those three things are enough to say we need a full independent investigation and get to the bottom of this.
You had a conversation with your husband in 2016 about running for president. You obviously came to the conclusion that you were not going to run for president. I wonder about that conversation. Was Hillary Clinton just too much of an obstacle in that race? And what other factors entered into your thinking?
So I talk about this in the book, about how people had started asking me after I'd been a senator for what felt like about an hour and a half.
That's about how long it took for Barack Obama to get those questions.
And I really thought, and I said in the book, you know, really? I felt like somebody needed a little more time and
now
a little more experience.
Now you've had it.
But, you know, ultimately, I decided not to run. But now what matters—
Why?
Well, part of it is, like I said, experience. Part of it is I really love the work I'm doing. I love being a senator, and I'm getting better at it. You know, I'm finding the places where I can make a difference. And sometimes it's a difference like being able to get the disaster relief for Massachusetts fishermen who got cheated out of it. And sometimes it's making a difference like reducing the number of opioids that are in circulation around the country. Sometimes it's a difference like oversight, like Wells Fargo.
But I have to tell you, I had an interview with President Obama the day after he met with Trump in the White House, after the election. I wouldn't say he was in a fantastic mood, and maybe he wasn't thinking as clearly as he usually does, but I said, okay, now Hillary Clinton is likely gone. You're gone. What's the Democratic bench? And he said, well, there's Kamala Harris, who had not spent one day in the Senate yet, and then he said, and oh, there's that mayor from
South Bend, Indiana, whose name he couldn't recall. And then it kind of dwindled off. He didn't say anything else. A lot of people look to you as a possibility in 2020. What's your early thinking about it? Do you rule yourself out, or do you keep that possibility alive?
Look, I'm not running for president. I'm running for Senate in 2018 in Massachusetts. But let me be clear. I think it's a mistake even to frame the question that way. I'll just be blunt. Donald Trump has not finished his first 100 days, and he's already delivered one punch to this nation after another. I am focused on what Donald Trump is likely to do before the end of the day today, what he does this week and next week and the week after. No, I'm dead serious about this. This is not about we can just put it all aside and start thinking about getting together a presidential race
but
for
somebody's
got
to think about that. You know how long it takes to run for president, what's involved in it.
No, what we've got to be thinking about is the fight right now. You know, I named the book, This Fight is Our Fight, not because we need to fight it later on, but because we need to fight it today. Look, if we hadn't been out there fighting, 24 million people would have lost their health care coverage. That would have sailed through the United States Congress and been signed into law by Donald Trump.
Do you think that's a closed question? Or is that going to be fought again and again and again?
It may be fought again and again and again, but I'll tell you, fighting it changed this world.
Changed the world how? How do you mean? It gave the possibility that you could win.
So that's exactly right. And that's why I talk about getting people into the fight and how to get people into the fight. Remember where we were on health care. The House had passed the repeal of Obamacare, 60-plus times? Senate was ready to go. And Donald Trump said on the stump, over and over and over, on day one, he would repeal Obamacare. So he gets sworn in, and we start getting active on our side. We start organizing. We start talking about it. We start pushing the notion, instead of just repeal, and then maybe they'll throw a few crumbs of health care our way. You got to repeal and replace, not repeal and run, repeal and replace. Even Donald Trump eventually picked up that phrase. Well, once they had to repeal and replace, who knew? It was complicated, as Donald Trump said. They got their feet tangled up, and more people had time to engage and started looking at what the plan was, at the 24 million people who would be pitched off, at whether or not there was really going to be protection on pre-existing conditions, and on and on. People got more engaged. And when they got more engaged, that changed the dynamic in Washington. No, Democrats didn't have a single vote more in the House or in the Senate. But here was the difference. That bill was stopped. I get it. It was stopped because for one group of Republicans, it was not brutal enough. But here's the deal. The rest of the Republicans would not follow them over that cliff. The rest of the Republicans looked around them and listened to America, the people who were showing up at rallies and at office hours and who were making calls and who were coming to town halls. And that is when the world shifted. The world shifted. And that is why it is imperative that we get in these fights. There is power in these fights.
How do you see the Democratic Party changing as a result of this last election? And are we seeing a profound political realignment going on? What shape is it taking in your view?
So I think the country has changed. This is the point I make right at the end of the book about democracy, about the Women's March, about making our voices heard and about the importance of the fight. And I think that's changing the Democratic Party. You know, this is where the energy in our party is right now. This is where our new ideas are coming from. This is where our willingness to plant our feet and punch back comes from. I think that's where the Democratic
Party
is.
But do you think
that
energy will expand and radiate out of the urban centers and the wealthier blue parts of the country? Is that possible?
Oh, what an awful way to ask the question.
Tell me what you
Lordy,
think.
Lordy, are we sitting in a fancy building in New York
when you
describe that? Excuse me, it's much of the rest of America that feels the anger and has taken the brunt of what 35
but
years
that's
of
not where
trickle
they vote.
Down
Absolutely, I agree with you, but that's not where the vote was.
It's look, there have been a lot of issues on the table for a long time now, and Democrats have not been good at getting out and both talking about the economic issues and even more importantly, fighting over the economic issues.
So fair enough. So I hear this all the time, and I hear it as a magazine editor. You hear it in many, many multiples more as a senator, somebody who's recognizable on the street. People are upset.
Mm-hmm.
They feel they're living in a kind of strange science fiction existence with Donald Trump on their TV screens every day, but they don't know what to do. They don't have jobs as an investigative reporter or as a senator or as a political activist. So somebody who's got, their life is encompassed by private life and their jobs and their day-to-day getting along and getting by, what do they do?
I'm actually fundamentally optimistic. Here's the thing about being active, being an activist. It's not like there's just a cup of activism, and once you've used up your cup of activism, that's it, you're done for the year. It's that doing something prompts you to do something else. Being engaged prompts you to get more engaged. Doing something prompts your sister to do something, your mom to do something. So what can you do? First thing is join up with some others. There are a lot of organizations now nationally that reach all across the country and some good local ones, but they magnify voices. They make sure that we stay energized and they make sure that we sharpen our message and come in on the point that's being fought right this minute. So join a group. Second, commit to make a difference every single day. One phone call a day, one phone call a day, one email a day. It's enough to get your voice in the game. I've watched it in the United States Senate. I have watched my colleagues say, God, we got a lot of calls today. Whoa, the switchboards were still going at 7 o'clock last
night. And it has
night,
an effect.
And at 8 o'clock last night. You bet it has an effect. Does it have all the effect I want? No. Betsy DeVos still got confirmed to be Secretary of Education. Yeah, I get it. We're going to lose a lot of these fights. But boy, being in the fight changes the world.
Senator Warren, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Senator Elizabeth Warren, her book, This Fight is Our Fight, The Battle to Save America's Middle Class, is out now.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.